Side 22. Gravity's Ring by Thomas Pynchon. Continuing on page 785. He's a cheerful and a plucky enough lad, and doesn't hold any of this against his father particularly. That old Broderick's just a murdering fool. Golly, what'll he come up with next? It's a giant factory state, a city of the future, full of extrapolated 930s, swoop-facaded and balconied skyscrapers, lean chrome caryatid with bobbed hairdos, classy airships of all descriptions drifting in the boom and hush of the city abysses, golden lovelies sunning in roof gardens and turning to wave to you as you pass. It is the Raketenstadt. Down below, thousands of kids are running in windy courtyards and areaways, up and down steps, skullcaps on their heads with plastic propellers spinning in the wind, rattling and blurred. Kids running messages among the plastic herbage in and out of the different soft plastic offices. Here's a memo for you, Tyrone. Go and find the Radiant Hour. Weepers, didn't know it was lost. Sounds like all pops up to some of those tricks. So it's out into the swarming corridors, full of larking dolls, pretty sub-deb secretaries on roller skates, produce carts, beanies whirling forever in the lights, cap gun or water pistol duels at each corner, kids dodging behind the spot fountains. Wait, that's a real gun. This is a real bullet. Zing! Good try, Pop, but you're not quite as keen as the kid today. Onward to rescue the Radiant Hour, which has been abstracted from the Days 24 by Colin the Father for sinister reasons of their own. Travel here gets complicated. A system of buildings that move by right angles along the grooves of the Raketenstadt's street grid. You can also raise or lower the building itself a dozen floors per second to desired heights or levels underground, like a submarine skipper with his periscope, although certain paths aren't available to you. They are to others, but not to you. Yes. Your objective is not the king. There is no king, but momentary targets, such as the Tower. Bing, in pops a kid with beanie spinning, hands slather up another message and spins off again. The Ray held captive. If you want to see her on display to all interested customers, be present at this address, 11:30 a.m. In the sky, a white clock face drifts conveniently by. Only half an hour to gather together my rescue team. Rescue team will consist Myrtle Miraculous flying in here in a shoulder-padded maroon dress still up in her hair and a tough frown for dragging her out of slumberland. Next, a negro in a pearl-gray zoot and Inverness cape, name of Million, high, square, pomaded head and a super-thin mustache comes zooming here out of his front job, the club Ooga Booga, where Beacon Street aristocracy rubs elbows every night with Roxbury winos and dope fiends. Yeah, hi, Tyrone. Here I is. Hello, Moyle baby. Yeah, yeah, yeah. What's the big rush, my man? Adjusting his carnation, looking round the room, everybody mark the familiar music box theme. Yes, it's that old-timery, sweet Stephen Foster music, and sure enough, in through the balcony window now comes Marcel, a mechanical chess player dating back to the Second Empire, fully built a century ago for the great conjurer Robert Houdin, very serious-looking French refugee kid, funny haircut with the ears perfectly outlined in hair that starts abruptly a quarter-inch strip of bare plastic skin away. Black patent shiny hair, horn-rimmed glasses, a rather remote manner, unfortunately much too literal, happens time Maximilian come hidey-hoeing in the door with one finger diving in the air, sees metal ebonite and plastic young Marcel sitting there and say, "Hey, man, give me some skin, man." Well, not only does Marcel give him a heavy time about skin in all its implications, oh no, that's only at the superficial level. Next, long discourse on the concept of give that goes on for a while, then he starts in on men. That's really an exhaustive one. In fact, Marcel isn't anywhere near finished with still his exquisite 19th century brainwork, the human art it took to build which has been flat lost as the dodo bird, has stood the floundering four in good stead on many, many go-rounds with the paternal peril. But where inside Marcel, midget grand master, the little Johann Allgeier? Where's the pantograph and the magnets? Nowhere. Marcel really is a chess player. No fakery inside to give him any touch of humanity at all. Each of the FF is, in fact, gifted while at the same time flawed by his gift, unfit by it for human living. Myrtle Miraculous specializes in performing miracles. stupendous feats, impossible for humans. She has lost respect for humans. They are clumsy. They fail. She does want to love them, but love is the only miracle that's beyond her. Love is denied her forever. The others of her class are either homosexuals, fanatics about law and order, off on strange religious excursions, or as intolerant of failure as herself. And though friends such as Mary Marvel and Wonder Woman keep inviting her to parties to meet eligible men, Myrtle knows it's no use. As for Maximilian, he has a natural sense of rhythm, which means all rhythms, up to and including the cosmic. So he will never be where the fathomless manhole awaits, where the safe falls from the high window shrieking like a bomb. He is a pilot through Earth's baddest minefields, if we only stay close to him. Be where he is as much as we can, yet Maximilian's doom is never to go any further into danger than its dapperness, its skin-exciting first feel. Fine crew, this is getting set to go off after Radiant. Say what? What's Slothrop's own gift and fatal? Aw, come on. The Radiant Hour, collecting their equipment, zooming to and fro, materializing this and that. The Golden Gate Bridge. How about that one? Let's see the other one again with, the Brooklyn, kind of old-fashioned looking. The Brooklyn Bridge, yeah, that's it. Whatever they are, the Brooklyn Bridge. See, for a chase scene, Myrtle, we ought to observe proportions. Do tell. Now, if we were going to be in high-speed automobiles, well, she might use the Golden Gate, but for Zoo the Air now, we need something older, more intimate, human. A pair of superlatively elegant Rolls-Royces. Quit fooling, Myrtle, we already agreed, didn't we? No automobiles? A small plastic baby's steering wheel. Ah, all right, I know you don't respect me as a leader, but let me be reasonable. Any wonder it's hard to feel much confidence in these idiots as they go up against pernicious pop each day? There's no real gain here, neither lines of power nor cooperation. Decisions are never really made. At best, they manage to emerge from a chaos of peeves, whims, hallucinations, and all-round assholery. This is less a fighting team than nest full of snits, blues, crotchets, and grudges, not a rare or fabled bird in the lot. It survives, after all, only a mutter of blind fortune groping through the heavy marbling of skies one titanic night at a time. Which is why Slothrop now observes his coalition with hopes for success and hopes for disastrously high. And no, that doesn't cancel out to apathy. It makes a loud dissonance that dovetails inside you, sharp as knives. It does annoy him that he can be so divided, so perfectly unable to come down on one side or another. Those whom the old Puritan sermons denounced as the glozing new of the world have no easy road to haul down. Where the panthers, just because you can't see it doesn't mean it's not there. Energy inside is just as real, just as binding and inevitable as energy that shows. When is the last time you felt intensely lukewarm, eh? Glozing neuters are just as human as heroes and villains. In many ways, they have the most grief to put up with, don't they? Why don't you, right now, wherever you folks are out in the country, snuggled in quilts or riding the bus, just turn to the glozing neuter nearest you, even your own reflection in the mirror, and just sing. Howdy, neighbor, howdy, pard. Ain't it lonely? Say, ain't it hard passing by so silent day after day without even a smile or a friendly word to say, oh, let me tell you, buddy, tell you, ace. Things are falling on their face. Maybe we should stick together part of the way and skies will be gay. Now, everybody. As the four suit up, voices continue singing for a while, depending how much each one happens to care, Myrtle displaying generous expanses of nifty gam, and Maximilian leering up beneath the fast-talking young tomato's skirts, drawing bewildered giggles from adolescent Marcel, may be a bit repressed. Now, Uthrop with a boobish, eager-to-please smile, time for that pause that refreshes. And he's into the icebox before Myrtle's oh Jesus has quite finished cooing. The light from the cold weed bulb turning his face to summer-light blue. Broderick and Naylene, oh child, their unconfessed, their monster son, who was born with hydraulic clamps for hands that know only how to reach and grab. And a heart that gurgles audibly like a funny fat man's stomach. But look how lost, how unarrested his face is, was, that 1.5 seconds in the glow from the folks the old icebox humming along in Kelvinator Bostonian dialect. Why, come on in, Tyrone. It's nice and friendly here in my stomach. Got lots of nice things like moxies and big baby Ruths. Walking now in among miles on the sky shelves and food mountains or food cities of icebox land. But look out, it can get pretty fascist in here behind the candy-colored sweet stuff is thermodynamic elitism at its clearest. Bulbs can be replaced with candles, and the radios fall silent, but the grid's big function in this system is ice-boxery, freezing back the tumultuous cycles of the day to preserve this odorless small world, this cube of changelessness. Climbing over the celery ridges, where the lettered cheese glasses loom high and glossy in the middle distance, flipping on the butter dish, pigging on the watermelon down to the rind, feeling yellow and bright as you skirt the bananas, gazing down at verdigris patches of mold across the crusted terrain of an old, no longer identifiable casserole. Bananas! Who's been putting bananas in the refrigerator? Oh, no, no, no. No, no, no. Chiquita Banana says we shouldn't. Something awful'll happen. Who would do that? It couldn't be Mom. And Hogan's in love with Chiquita Banana. Tyrone's come in the room plenty of times, found his brother with banana label glued on his cock for ready reference. Lost in masturbatory fantasies of nailing this cute but older Latin lady while she's wearing her hat. Gigantic fruit market hat and a big saucy smile. Aye, how passionate you Yankees are. Eh, and it couldn't have been Pop. No, Pop wouldn't. But if it... Is it getting cold in here? Wasn't any of us, then what's happening to the Spike Jones record of Right in the Fuhrer's Face playing back in the living room? Why is the sound fake? Unless I did it without knowing. Look around, something's squeaking on its hinges. And maybe that means I'm going crazy. What's this brightening the bulb light? What's... Slam! Well, whoever it is that's been wanting regarding United Fruits radio commercials has also just closed young Tyrone in that icebox, and now he'll have to count on Myrtle to get him out, embarrassing as heck. Good thinking, boss man. E.M.M., I don't know what happened. Do you ever? Grab onto my cape. Whoosh. Phew. Well, says Slothrop. Are we all? That radiant hour's probably 8 years away by now, says Mert, and you have a snot icicle hanging out of your nose. Martell springs to the controls of the mobile building, keys in control, a request for omnidirectional top speed clearance, which sometimes comes through and sometimes not, depending on a secret process among the granters of permission, a process it is one of the four's ongoing mandates to discover and impart to the world. This time they get slow crawl, suburban vectors, lowest traffic status in the Raketenstadt, involved only once in recorded history against a homosexual child-murdering Indian, liked to wipe off his organ afterwards on the flag, and so on. Shit, hollers Maximilian at Slothrop. Slow crawl suburban vectors, what the fuck we supposed to do, man? Swim or some shit? Myrtle, Slothrop approaches gold-snooted M.M. a little different. Do you think you could... Jesus, they run through this same routine every time. Doesn't Myrtle wish sniveling Slothrop would cut wishy-washy malarkey and be a man for once? She lights a cigarette, lets it droop from one corner of her mouth, juts out the opposite hip and sighs, on the beam, exasperated already with this creep. And loss! The miracle is done. They're now zipping along the corridor streets of the Raketenstadt like some long-necked sea monster. Little kids boil up like ants on the webby edges of viaducts high over the city, dripping stone like Spanish moss petrified in mid-collapse, kids up over the airy railings and on the friendly back of the sleek city-oozing monster. They climb window to window, with grace ever to fall. Some of them, naturally, are spies. That honey-curled little cutie, the blue-checked pinafore and blue knee socks, up there under the gargoyle at the window listening in to Maximilian, who began drinking early as soon as the building started to move, and is now carrying on a long denunciation of under the thin scholarly disguise of trying to determine if the Gallic genius could be said to have any soul. The young lady under gargoyle is taking it all down in shorthand. These are valuable data for the psychological warfare effort. For the first time now, it becomes apparent that the Four and the Father Conspiracy do not entirely fill their world. Their struggle is not the only or even the ultimate one. Indeed, not only are there many other struggles, but there are also spectators, watching, as spectators will do, hundreds of thousands of sitting around this dingy yellow amphitheater, seat after seat plunging down in and tears endless miles down to the great arena, brown yellow lights, food scattered on the stone slopes up higher, broken buns, peanut shells, bones, bottles half-filled with green or orange sweet, fires in small wind rattles where seats have been chiseled away, shallow depressions in the stone and a bed of cherry embers where old women are cooking hashes of the scavenged bits and crumbles and gristly lumps of food, heating them in thin frying pans of gray oil water bubbling as the faces of children gather around to wait for food, and in the wind, the dark young man, the slippery young knife who waits for your maid outside the iron gate each Sunday, who takes her away to a stranger's automobile and a shape of love you can never imagine, stands now with his hair untended in the wind, his head averted from the fire, feeling the cold, the mountain cold at his temples and high under his jaw, while beside other fires the women gossip, one craning over now and then to look miles downward at the stage to see if a new episode's come on yet. Crowds of students running by dark as ravens, coats draped around shoulders, back out a murky sector of seats which additionally are never entered, being reserved for the ancestors, their voices fading, still very intense, dramatic, trying to sound good or at least acceptable. The women go on, playing cards, smoking, eating. See if you can borrow a blanket from Rose's fire over there. It's going to be cold tonight. Hey, and a pack of armies while you're out. And come right back, hear me? Of course, the cigarette machine turns out to be Marcel. Who else? In another of his clever mechanical disguises, and inside one pack is a message for one of the spectators. I'm sure you wouldn't want them to know about the summer of 1945. Meet me in the male transvestite's toilet, L16/39C, station Metatron, quadrant fire, stall Malkut. Know what time? The usual hour. Don't be late. What's this? What are the antagonists doing here, infiltrating their own audience? Well, they're not, really. It's somebody else's audience at the moment, and these nightly spectacles are an appreciable part of the dark side hour's life of the rocket capital. The chances for any paradox here, really, are less than you think. Maximilian is way down in the bottom of the orchestra pit, posing as the C melody saxophone player, complete with closet intellectual book, The Wisdom of Great Kamikaze Pilots, with illustrations by Walt Disney. Screaming, hairy-nosed, front white, dihedral, slant-eyed, long elaborate curlicued shapes, round black licorice dog-nosed Japs, zooming through every page. And playing that saxophone, you're sure Maximilian will be, to the casual observer, immersed in this diffuse, though rewarding, work. Myrtle, meantime, is back in the candy cane control room, manning the switchboard and ready to swoop in at any time to save the others who are sure, through their own folly if nothing else, to be in deep trouble soon. And Slothrop himself lurks in the transvestite's toilet, in the smoke, the crowds, the buzzing fluorescent lights, as hot as melted butter, making notes of all the dealing going on among the stalls, bowls and urinals. You've got to look butch, but not that butch. And another thing, no metal showing at any vital spots. She'll knock off 10 marks for everyone she sees. And the only bonuses she gives are spelled out here. Blood drawn, no first try. That's an extra 20. Wondering if the cigarette pack message got through, and if they'll come in person, or if Pop will send a hitman to try for a first-round KO. Well, there is the heart of it. The monumental yellow structure out there in the slum suburban night. The never-sleeping percolation of life and enterprise through its shell, outside and inside interpiercing one another too fast, too finely labyrinthine for either category to have much hegemony anymore. The non-stop review crosses its stage, crowding and thinning, surprising and jerking tears in an endless ratchet. The low-frequency listener. The German U-boat communicated on a wavelength of 28,000 meters, which is down around 10 kilocycles. A half-wave antenna for that would have to be 9 miles high or long, and even folded here and there, it is still some antenna. It is located at Magdeburg, so is the headquarters of the German branch of Jehovah's Witnesses. So, for a time, is Slothrop attempting to get through to the Argentine anarchist U-boat now in unknown waters. The reason why is no longer clear to him. He was either visited again in some way by Squalidossi, or he came on Squalidossi one day by accident, or he found in some linking, attentionless search through pockets, rags, or bedroll, the message he went back at the green edge of ages at the Café L'Eclipse long ago in Geneva. All he knows, being Squalidossi right now, is his overriding need. The cure of the antenna is a Jehovah's Witness named Rohr. He's just out of the Raffensburg camp after being in, can't remember. With that much camp time in, he's politically reliable enough for the local G5 to put him, Knight, in control of the network of longest wavelength in the zone, although this could be accidental. More likely there is some eccentric justice lately begun to operate, which it would behoove Slot to look into. There are rumors of a war crimes tribunal underway in Nuremberg. No one Slothrop listened to is clear who's trying whom for what, but remember that these are mostly brains ravaged by antisocial and mindlessers. But the only people, if any, apt to be communicating these days on 28,000s, the distance from test stand 7 at Peenemünde to the Hafenstrasse in Greifswald, where Slothrop in early August may see a particular news photo, except for freak Argentine anarchists, are the undenazified Nazis still wandering around in unaccounted for submarines holding their own secret shipboard tribunals against enemies of the Reich. So the closest thing to an early Christian is put on to listen for news of unauthorized crew. Someone the other night was dying, Rohr tells him. I don't know if he was inside the zone or out at sea. He wanted to... Should I have got on and told him about priests? Found any comfort in that? It's painful sometimes. We're really trying to be Christians. My folks were Congregationalist, Slothrop offers, I think. It's getting harder to remember either of them as Broderick progresses into pernicious pop and Nalene into into what? What was that word? Whatever it is, the harder he chases, the faster it goes away. Mom Slothrop's letter to Ambassador Kennedy.
Well, hi, Joe. How have you been? Listen, Giuseppe, we're getting edgy about our youngest again. Would you try bothering a few of those old London connections just for us? Even if it's old news, it'll be good news for Poppy and I. I still remember what you said when the awful word about the PT boat came in before how Jack was. I'll never forget your words then. It's every parent's dream, Joe, that it is. Oh, and Jose, whoop, ain't that the pen just skidded, as you can see. Naughty Nalene's third martini, we'll have you know. He and I heard you're wonderful at the GE plant over in the week. You're in the groove, Mr. K? How true. We've got to modernize in Massachusetts, or it'll just keep getting worse and worse. They're supposed to be taking a strike vote here next week. Wasn't the WLB set up to prevent just that? It isn't starting to break down, is it, Joe? Sometimes, you know, these fine Boston days when the sky over the hill is broken into clouds, the way white bread appears through a crust you hold at your golden clouds. Sometimes I think, ah, Joe, I think they're falling down. I'm so sudden. It's just, part is it, my old fellow? Sometimes things aren't very clear, that's all. Things look like they're going to say, oh, of course, it had to happen that way. Otherwise, so-and-so wouldn't have happened. Still, while it's happening, in my heart, I keep getting this terrible fear, this empty place. And it's very hard at such times really to believe in a plan with a shape bigger than I can see. Oh, anyway, grumpy old thoughts away. Shoo, martini number 4 coming up. Jack's a fine boy. Really, I love Jack like Hogan and Tyrone, just like a son, my son. I even love him like I don't love my sons. Ha ha, she croaks. But then I'm a wicked old babe, you know that. No hope for the likes of me.
On the phrase, ass backwards. Something I have never understood about your language, Yankee Pig. Zoira has been calling him Yankee Pig all day now, a hilarious joke he will not leave alone, often getting no further than Yank before collapsing into some horrible twanging ease of a laugh, coughing up alarming ropey lungers, many colors and marbling effects. Green, for example, old statue green at leafy dusk. Sure, replies Slothrop. You want to learn English? Me teachy you English. Ask me anything, Kraut. It is exactly the kind of blanket offer that's always getting Slothrop in trouble. Why do you speak of certain reversals, machinery connected wrong, for instance, as being ass backwards? I can't understand that. Ass usually is backwards, right? You'll be saying ass forwards, if backwards is what you mean. Says Slothrop. This is only one of many American mysteries, Zoira sighs. I wish somebody could clear up for me. A few, obviously. Zoira got a lot of gall picking on other people's language like this. One night back when he was a second-story man, he had the incredible luck to break into the affluent home of Minnie Chletch, an astrologer of the Hamburg school, who was, genitally it seems, unable to pronounce, even perceive, umlauts over vowels. That night she was just coming on to what would prove to be an overdose of hieropon when Zoira, who back in those days was a curly-haired and good-looking kid, surprised her in her own bedroom with his hand around an ivory chessloifer with a sarcastic smile on its face and filled with good raw Peruvian cocaine still full of the earth. Don't call for help, advises Zoira, flashing his phony acid bottle, or that pretty face goes flowing off of its bones like a pudding. But Minnie calls his bluff, starts hollering for help to all the ladies of the same age in her building who feel that same motherly help, help, but make sure there's time for him to rate me ambivalence about nubile cat burglars. What she means to scream is, Psch, Räuber! Hübsch, Räuber! which means cute-looking robber, cute-looking robber. But she pronounced those umlauts, so it comes out Hubschrauber, which means helicopter, helicopter. Well, it's 1920-something, and nobody in earshot even knows what the word means. Lifter? What's that? Nobody except one finger-biting, paranoid aerodynamics student in a tenement courtyard far away who heard the scream late in Berlin night over tram-clashing rifle shots in another quarter, a harmonica novice who has been trying to play Deutschland, Deutschland über alles for the past 4 hours, over and over missing notes, fucking up the time, the breathing, über alles in die... Then long, long pause. Oh, come on, asshole, you can find it. Weltsauer. Ach, immediately corrected. Through all that to him comes the cry, Hubschrauber, Liftruher, a helix through cork air over wine of earth falling bright. Yes, he knows exactly. And can this cry be a prophecy? A warning, the sky full of them, gray police in the hatchways with ray guns cradled like cog pieces beneath each whirling screw. We see you from above. There is nowhere to go. It's your last alley, your last storm cellar. To stay inside and not interfere? He stays inside and does not interfere. He goes on to become Spöri of Horst Achtfaden's confession to the Schwarzkommando. But he didn't go to see what Minnie was hollering about that. She would have OD'd except for friend Wimpe, an up-and-coming IG salesman covering the Eastern Territory, who'd blown into town after unexpectedly dumping all of his onarine samples of American tourists back in hilltop Transylvania looking for a new kind of thrills. It's me, Liebchen. Didn't expect to be back, so... But then he saw the sprawled satin creature, red pupil size and skin tint, swiftly went to his leather case for stimulant and syringe. That and an ice-filled bathtub got her back okay. Ass is an intensifier, Seaman Bodine now offers, as in mean ass, stupid ass. Well, when something is very backwards, by analogy, you'd say backwards ass. But ass backwards is backwards ass backwards, Zoya objects. But gee, that don't make it mean forwards, blinks Bodine with a sincere little break in his voice as if somebody's just about to hit him. Actually, this is a bit of private fun for the spirited salt. It is a William Bendix imitation. Let the others do Cagney and Cary Grant. Bodine specializes in supporting roles. He can do a perfect Arthur Kennedy as Cagney's kid brother. How about that? Or Cary Grant's faithful Indian water bearer, Sam Jaffe. He is a white hat in the navy of life, and that extends to vocal impressions of the fake film lives of strangers. Zoyra, meantime, is into something like this with instrumental soloists, or trying, teaching himself kind of by trial and error, currently ee-aw-awing his way through some hypothetical Joachim playing his own cadenza from the long-suppressed Rossini violin concerto, opus posthumous, and in the process driving the household mad. One morning, Trudy just goes stomping away into an 82nd airborne mass jump over the conquered city, a million fleecy canopies in the sky falling slow as white ash behind around the silhouette of her goodbye stump. He's driving me crazy. Hi, Trudy. Where are you going? I just told you. Crazy. And don't think this wretched old horny dope fiend doesn't love her, because he does. And don't think he isn't praying, writing down his wishes carefully on cigarette papers, rolling up in them his finest sacramental kiff and smoking them down to a blister on the lip, which is the dope fiend's version of wishing on an evening star, hoping in his heart she's just off on another stomp. Please, only a stomp. Let it be over inside the day just one more time, he writes on each good night's reefer. That's all I won't ask again. I'll try not to. You know me. Don't judge me too hard, please. But how many more of these stomps can there be? One's going to be the last. Still, he keeps on ee-aw-awing with the Rossini, radiating his mean, lean, living-at-the-edge street longevity. No, he can't seem to stop it. It's an old man's habit. He hates himself, but it just comes on him. No matter what attention he brings to the problem, he can't stop drifting back into the catchy cadenza. Seaman Bodine understands and is trying to help. To set up a useful interference, he has composed his own counter-cadenza along the lines of those other pop tunes with classical names big around 1945. My Prelude to a Kiss, Tenement Symphony. Every chance he gets, Bodine will croon it to the new weekly arrivals. Lali just in from Lübeck, Sandra who's run away from the Kleinburger Straße. Here's vile Bodine with his guitar ambling, pelvis wiggling down the hallway after each naughty defector, each choice little sex crime fantasy made flesh, singing and picking a moving rendition of My Doper's Cadenza. If you hear a box so sweet, playing tunes with a peppy beat that's just my doper's cadenza. Melodies that get you so, where they come from, I don't know. Ha ha, it's just my doper's cadenza. This is the cadenza part. Now I know it's not as keen as old Rossini, snatch of La Gazza Ladra here, nor as grand as Bach or Beethoven or Brahms. Boo 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 boo, sung to opening of Beethoven Fifth with full band. But I'd give away the fames of 100 Harry James. Wait, fame? Of 100 James? Jameses? Fameses? Scherzoso. If this little song can bring you to my arms. Dum de dum de dum de dee. Oh, it's better than a symphony. It's my doper's cadenza to you. These days, the tenement is known as Der Platz, and is nearly filled up all the way into the last central courtyard with friends of Zoira's. The change is unexpected. A lot more vegetation seems to be growing now in the tenement dirt, an ingenious system of home-carpentered light ducts and mirrors adjusted throughout the day send sunlight, for the first time, down into these back courts, revealing colors never seen before. There's also a rain structure to route the rain among flumes, funnels, splash reflectors, water wheels, nozzles, and weirs to make a system of rivers and waterfalls to play in this summer. The only rooms that can still be locked from the inside are reserved for isolates, fetishists, lost stumblers in out of the occupation who need loneliness like the dope fiend needs his dope. Speaking of which, everywhere in the complex now you can find army dope of all kinds stashed from cellars to mansard floors are littered with wire loops and plastic covers from half-grain syrettes of morphine tartrate, squeezed toothpaste tube empty, broken amyl nitrate containers looted from anti-gas kits, olive-drab tins of benzedrine. Work is proceeding on an anti-police moat around the entire tenement. To keep from drawing attention, this moat here is the first in history being dug from inside out. The space directly below the Jakobistrasse slowly, paranoically, is hollowed, sculpted, carefully shored up under the thin crust of street so the odd tram won't find itself in unscheduled plunge. Though it has been known to happen, out in the late night with interior tram lights warm-colored as clear broth, out on the peripheral runs through long stretches of unlighted park or along singing fences of storage depots all at once like a mouth pursing MF, the black top buckles, and you're down in some dripping paranoid's moat. The night shift staring in with huge denizen of the underground eyes, faced not with you so much as with the agonizing problem of deciding, is this a real bus or are these passengers really police agents in disguise? Well, it's a touchy business, touchy. Somewhere in their plots now, early morning, somebody's two-year-old, a baby as fat as a suckling pig, just learned the word Sonnenschein. Sunshine, says the baby, pointing. Sunshine, running into the other room. Sunshine, croaks some grown-up morning voice. Sunshine, hollers the baby, tottering off. Sunshine, a smiling girl voice, maybe his mother. Sunshine, the baby at the window, showing her, showing anybody else who'll look exactly. Shit and Shinola. Now, Zoira wants to know, you will tell me about the American expression shit from Shinola. What is this? Screams Simon Bodine. I'm being set tasks now. This is some continuing study of American slang or some shit. Tell me, you old fool, grabbing Zoira by throat and lapel and shaking him asymmetrically. You're one of them, too, right? Come on. The old man, Raggedy Andy in his hands, a bad morning of suspicion here for the usually mellow Bodine. Stop, stop, snivels the amazed Zoira, amazement giving way, that is, to a sniveling conviction that the hairy American gob has lost his mind. Well, you've heard the expression, shit from Shinola, as in, oh, he don't know shit from Shinola about that, or, Marine, you don't know shit from Shinola, and you get sent to the onion room, or worse. One implication is that shit and Shinola are in wildly different categories. You would envision, maybe just because they smell different, no way for shit and Shinola to coexist. Simply impossible. A stranger to the English language, a German dope fiend such as Zoira, not knowing either word, might see shit as a comical interjection. One a lawyer in a bowler hat folding up papers, tucking them in a tan briefcase, might smiling use. Shit, Herr Boomer. And he walks out of your cell, the oily bastard forever. Or, shit, Down comes a cartoon guillotine on one black-and-white politician, head bouncing downhill, lines to indicate amusing little spherical vortex patterns, and you thought, yes, like to see that, all right, yes, cut it off, one less rodent, shit ya. As for Shinola, we pass to universitarians, Franz Pöckler, Kurt Mondaugen, Bert Fiebel, Horst Achtfaden, and others. Their Shinola is a shimmering Albert Speer-style alabaster open-air stadium, with giant cement birds of prey up at each corner, wings shrugged forward, sheltering under each wing shadow a hooded German face. From the outside, the hall is golden, the white gold precisely of one lily-of-the-valley petal in 4 o'clock sunlight, serene at the top of a small, artificially graded hill. It has a talent, this seeming hall, for posing up profiles in front of noble clouds to suggest persistence, through returns of spring, hopes for love, meltings of snow and ice, academic Sunday tranquillities, smells of grass just crushed or cut or later turning to hay. But inside the Shine Aula, all is blue and cold as the sky overhead, blue as a blueprint or a planetarium. No one in here knows which way to look. Will it begin above us, down there, behind us, in the middle of the air, and how soon? Well, there's one place where shit and Shinola do come together, and that's in the men's toilet at the Roseland Ballroom. The place Slothrop departed from on his trip down the toilet, as revealed in the St. Veronica papers, preserved mysteriously from that hospital's great holocaust. Shit now is the color white folks are afraid of. Shit is the presence of death. Not some abstract, arty character with a scythe, but the stiff and rotting corpse itself inside the white man's warm and private own asshole, which is getting pretty intimate. That's what that white toilet's for. You see many brown toilets? Nope, toilets the color of gravestones. Classical columns of mausoleums, that white porcelain's the very emblem of odorless and official death. Shinola shoeshine polish happens to be the color of shit. Shoeshine boy Malcolm's in the toilet slapping on the Shinola, working off white man's penance on his sin of being born the color of shit and Shinola. It is nice to think that one Saturday night, one floor-shaking, lindy-hopping Roseland night, Malcolm looked up from some Harvard kid's shoes and caught the eye of Jack Kennedy, the ambassador's son, then a senior. Nice to think that young Jack may have had one of them immortal light bulbs then go on overhead. Did Red suspend his rag-popping just a shadow of a beat, just enough gap in the moiré there to let White Jack see through, not through two, but through the shine on his classmate Tyrone Slothrop's shoes? Were the three ever lined up that way, sitting, squatting, passing through? Eventually, Jack and Malcolm both got murdered. Slothrop's fate is not so clear. It may be that they have something different in mind for Slothrop. An incident in the transvestite's toilet. A small ape or orangutan holding something behind his back comes sidling unobserved among net-stockinged legs, bobby socks rolled down to loop under ankle bones, sub-deb beanies tucked into rayon aquamarine waist sashes. Finally, he reaches Slothrop, who is wearing a blonde wig and the same long, flowing, white, cross-banded number Faye Ray wears in her screen test scene with Robert Armstrong on the boat. Considering his history in the Roseland toilet, Slothrop may have chosen this gown not only out of some repressed desire to be sodomized, unimaginably, by a gigantic black ape, but also because of an athletic innocence to Faye that he's never spoken of except to point and whisper, "Oh, look!" Some honesty, pluck, a cleanness to the garment itself, its enormous sleeves, so that wherever you pass is visibly where you've been. At that first moment, long before our flight, ravine, Tyrannosaurus flying mares and jaws cracked out of joint, the buzzing serpent that jumped you in your own stone living space, the pterodactyl or the fall, no, just while I first hung there, forest and night at one, hung waiting with the torches on the wall, and waiting for the night's one shape to come, I prayed then, not for Jack, still mooning sappy along the weather decks, no, I was thinking of Denim. Only him, with gun and camera wisecracking in his best bum actor's way, through darkest earth, making the unreal real by shooting at it, one way or the other. Carl Denham, my director, my undying Carl. Ah, show me the key light. whisper me a line. We've seen them under a thousand names. Greta Erdmann is only one. These dames whose job it is always to cringe from the terror. Well, home from work, they fall asleep just like us and dream of assassinations, of plots against good and decent men. The ape reaches up, taps Slothrop on the ass, hands him what he's been carrying. Yah, it's a round black iron anarchist bomb's what it is, with lit fuse, too. Ape goes scampering away. Slothrop just stands there in the glassed and humid rooms, his makeup starting to run, consternation in his eyes, clear as marbles and lips pressed into a bee-stung. Well, what the heck am I supposed to do now? He can't say anything. The contact still hasn't showed, and his voice would blow his disguise. The fuse is burning shorter and shorter. Slothrop looks around. All the washbowls and urinals are occupied. Should he just put the fuse out in front of somebody's cock right in the stream of piss? But wouldn't that look like I was propositioning them or something? Gee, sometimes I wish I wasn't so indecisive. Maybe if I picked somebody weaker than me. But then it's the little guy's got the reflexes, remember? He is rescued from his indecision by a very tall, fat, somewhat oriental-looking transvestite whose ideal, screen and personal, seems to be little Margaret O'Brien. Somehow this Asiatic here is managing to look pigtailed and wistful even as he snatches the sputtering bomb away from Slothrop, runs, heaves it into an empty toilet bowl, and flushes it, turning back to Slothrop and the others with an air of civic duty well done, when suddenly, Krapaluma, comes this giant explosion. Water leaps in a surprised blue-green tongue. Ever seen a toilet hollering yikes? Out of every single black-lidded bowl, pipes wrench and scream, walls and floors shudder, plaster begins to fall in crescents and powder sheets as all the chattering transvestites fall silent, reach out to touch anyone nearby as a gesture of preparation for the voice out of the loudspeaker saying, "That was a sodium bomb. Sodium explodes when it touches water." So the fuse was a dummy, the dirty rat. "You saw who threw it in the toilet. He is a dangerous maniac. Apprehend him, and there'll be a large reward. Your closet could make Norma Shearer's look like the wastebasket in Gimbel's basement." So they all leap on the poor, protesting Margaret O'Brien devotee, while Slothrop, for whom the humiliation and, presently, as the arrival of the police grows later and later, the sexual abuse and torture were really intended, gotta hand it to you, Pop, flips away, loosening as he nears the outside the satin ties of his gown, dragging reluctantly off of his grease-chevroned head the shining wig of innocence. A moment of fun with Takeshi and Ichizo, the comical kamikazes. Takeshi is tall and fat, but doesn't braid his hair like that Margaret O'Brien. Ichizo is short and skinny. Takeshi flies a zero, while Ichizo flies an Oka device, which is a long bomb, actually, with a cockpit for Ichizo to sit in, stub wings, rocket propulsion, and a few control surfaces back aft. Takeshi only had to go to kamikaze school for 2 weeks on Formosa. Ichizo had to go to Oka school for 6 months in Tokyo. They are as different as peanut butter and jelly, these two. No fair asking which is which. They are the only two kamikazes out here at this airbase, which is rather remote, actually, on an island that nobody, well, really cares much about anymore. The fighting is going on at Leyte, then on to Iwo Jima, moving toward Okinawa, but always too far away for any sortie from here to reach. But they have their orders and their exile. Not much to do for kicks but go wandering on the beaches looking for dead Cypridini. These are crustaceans with three eyes, shaped like a potato with cat whiskers at one end. Dried and powdered, Cypridini are also a great source of light. To make the stuff glow in the dark, all you do is add water. The light is blue, weird, multi-shaded blue, some green in it and some indigo, amazingly cool and nocturnal blue. On moonless or overcast nights, Takeshi and Ichizo take off all their clothes and splash each other with Cypridina light, running and giggling under the palm trees. Every morning, and sometimes evening, too, the scatterbrained suicide kicks mosey down to the palm-thatched radar shack to see if there's any American targets worth a crash dive, anywhere inside their flying radius. But it's the same story every time. Old Kenosho, the loony radar man who's always brewing up a batch of that sake back in the transmitter room, in a still he's hooked up to a magnetron tube in some fiendish nip way that defies Western science, every time the fellows show up, this drunken old reprobate starts cackling, "No dying today, no dying today, so sorry." pointing at all the blank PPI scopes, green radii sweeping silent round and round, trailing clear webs of green shampoo. Nothing but surface return for more miles than you can fly, and of the fatal mandala both hearts would leap to. Green carrier blob screened eightfold in a circle of destroyer strokes. Nothing. No, each morning the same. Only the odd white cap and old hysterical Kenosho, who by now is on the floor, gagging on saliva and tongue, having his seizure, an eagerly awaited part of each daily visit, each fit trying to top the one before, or at least bring in a new twist. A back flip in the air, a gnaw or two after Takeshi's blue and yellow patent wingtips, an improvised haiku. The lover leaps in the volcano. It's 10 feet deep and inactive. As the two pilots mug, giggle, and jump around, trying to avoid the grizzled old radar man's thrashings. What? You didn't like the haiku? It wasn't ethereal enough? Not Japanese at all? In fact, it sounded like something right out of Hollywood? Well, Captain, yes, you, Marine Captain Esberg from Pasadena, you have just had the mystery insight. Gasps and a burst of premonitory applause. And so you are our paranoid for the day. Band burst into button up your overcoat or any other suitably paranoid up-tempo tune as the bewildered contestant is literally yanked to his feet and dragged out in the aisle by this MC with the gleaming face and rippling jaw. Yes, it is a movie, another World War II situation comedy, and your chance to find out what it's really like, because you have won, drumroll, more gasps, more applauding and whistling, an all-expense one-way trip for one to the movie's actual location, exotic Pukahukaluki Island. The orchestra's ukulele section taking up now a tinkling reprise of that white man welcome tune we last heard in London being directed at Geza Rojavolgi on a giant TWA constellation. You'll while your nights away chasing vampire mosquitoes away from your own throat. Getting blind lost out in the middle of torrential tropical downpours. Scooping rat turds out of the enlisted men's water barrel. But it won't be all nighttime giddiness and excitement, Captain, because daytimes, up at 5 a.m. sharp, you'll be out making the acquaintance of the Kamikaze Zero you'll be flying. Getting all checked out on those controls, making sure you know just where that bomb safety release is. A hand, of course, trying to stay out of the way of those two nonsensical nips, Takeshi and Ichizo, as they go about their uproarious weekly adventures, seemingly oblivious to your presence and the frankly ominous implications of your day's routine. Streets. Strips of insulation hang up in the morning fog after a night of moon brightening and darkening as if by itself, because the blowing fog was so smooth, so hard to see. Now, when the wind blows, yellow sparks will spill away with a rattlesnake buzz from the black old fraying wires against a sky gray as a hat. Green glass insulators go cloudy and blind in the day. Wood poles lean and smell old, 30-year-old wood. Carry transformers hum aloft, as if it will really be a busy day. In the middle distance, poplars just emerge out of the haze. It could have been the Semlowerstrasse in Stralsund. The windows have the same ravaged look. The insides of all the rooms seem to have been gutted black. Perhaps there is a new bomb that can destroy only the insides of structures. No, it was in Greifswald. Across some wet railroad tracks were derricks, superstructure, tackle, smells of canal side. Hafenstrasse in Greifswald, down over his back fell the cold shadow of some massive church. But isn't that the Petritor, that stunted brick tower arch straddling the alleyway ahead? It could be the Schlüberstrasse in the old part of Rostock, or the Wandfärberstrasse in Lüneburg, with pulleys high up on the brick gables, openwork weathercocks up at the very peaks. Why was he looking upward? Upward from any of a score of those northern streets one morning in the fog. The farther north, the plainer things grow. There's one gutter down the middle of the alley where the rain runs off. Cobbles are laid straighter and there aren't as many cigarettes to be had. Garrison churches echo with starlings. To come into a northern zone town is to enter a strange harbor from the sea on a foggy day. But in each of these streets, some vestige of humanity, of earth, has to remain. No matter what has been done to it, no matter what it's been used for. There were men called army chaplains. They preached inside some of these buildings. There were actually soldiers dead now who sat or stood and listened. holding on to what they could. Then they went out, and some died before they got back inside a garrison church again. Clergymen working for the army stood up and talked to the men who were going to die about God, death, nothingness, redemption, salvation. It really happened. It was quite common. Even in a street used for that, still there will be one time, one dyed afternoon, coal tar impossible, orange-brown, clear all the way through, or one day of rain and clearing before bedtime, and in the yard one hollyhock, circling in the wind, fresh with raindrops fat enough to be chewed. One face by a long sandstone wall, and the scuffle of all the doomed horses on the other side, one hair part thrown into blue shadows at a turn of her head. One busful of faces passing through in the middle of the night, no one awake in the quiet square but the driver, the Ortschutz sentry in some kind of brown official-looking uniform, old Mauser at sling arms, dreaming not of the enemy outside in the swamp or shadow, but of home and bed, strolling now with his civilian friend, who's off duty, can't sleep, under the trees full of road dust and night, through their shadows on the sidewalks playing a harmonica. Down past the row of faces in the bus, drowned man green, insomniac, tobacco-starved, scared, not of tomorrow, not yet, but of this pause in their night passage, of how easy it will be to lose, and how much it will hurt. At least one moment of passage, one it will hurt to lose, ought to be found for every street now indifferently gray with commerce, with war, with repression. Finding it, learning to cherish what was lost, mightn't we find some way back? In one of these streets, in the morning fog, plastered over two slippery cobblestones, is a scrap of newspaper headline with a wire photo of a giant white cock dangling in the sky straight downward out of a white cubic bush. The letters MBDROROSHI appear above with the logo of some occupation newspaper, a grinning glamour girl riding astraddle the cannon of a tank, steel penis with slotted serpent head, third armored, treads and triangle on a sweater rippling across her tits. The white image has the same coherence, the hey, look at me smugness, as the cross does. It is not only a sudden white genital onset in the sky, it is also, perhaps, a tree. Slothrop sits on a curbstone watching it, and the letters, and girl with steel cock waving high fellas as the fog whitens into morning, and figures with carts or dogs or bicycles go by in brown-gray outlines, wheezing, greeting briefly in fog-flattened voices, passing. He doesn't remember sitting on the curb for so long staring at the picture, but he did. At the instant it happened, the pale virgin was rising in the east, head, shoulders, breasts, 17 degrees, 36 minutes down to her maidenhead at the horizon. A few doomed Japanese knew of her as some western deity. She loomed in the eastern sky, gone at the city about to be sacrificed. The sun was in Leo. The fireburst came roaring and sovereign. Listening to the toilet. The basic idea is that they will come and shut off the water first. The cryptozoa who live around the meter will be paralyzed by the great inbreak of light from overhead, then scatter like hell for lower, darker, wetter. Shutting the water off interdicts the toilet. With only one tankful left, you really can't get rid of much of anything anymore. Dope, shit, documents. They've stopped the inflow-outflow, and here you are trapped inside their frame with your wastes piling up, ass hanging out all over their movie-ola viewer, waiting for their editorial blade. Reminded, too late, of how dependent you are on them, for neglect if not goodwill. Their neglect is your freedom. But when they do come on, it's like society gig Apollo's striking the lyre. Zong! Everything freezes. The sweet, icky chord hangs in the air. There is no way to be at ease with it. If you try the, are you quite finished, Superintendent Gambit? The man will answer, no, as a matter of fact, no, you nasty little wet-mouthed prig, I'm not half finished, not with you. So it's good policy always to have the toilet valve cracked a bit, to maintain some flow through the toilet so when it stops, you'll have that extra minute or two, which is not the usual paranoia of waiting for a knock or a phone to ring. No, it takes a particular kind of mental illness to sit and listen for a cessation of noise. But imagine this very elaborate scientific lie, that sound cannot travel through outer space. Well, but suppose it can. Suppose they don't know there is a medium there, what used to be called an ether, carry sound to every part of the earth. Ferrous ether. For millions of years, the sun has been roaring, a giant furnace 93-million-mile roar, so perfectly steady that generations of men have been born into it and passed out of it again without ever hearing it. Unless it changed, how would anybody know? Except that at night, now in the part of the dark hemisphere, because of eddies in the soniferous ether, there will come to pass a very shallow pocket of no sound. For a few seconds, in a particular place, nearly every night, somewhere in the world, sound energy from outside is shut off. The roaring of the sun stops. For its brief life, the point of sound shadow may come to rest 1,000 feet above a desert, between floors in an empty office building, or exactly around a seated individual in a working-class restaurant where they hose the place out at 3 every morning. It's all white tile, the chairs and tables riveted solid into the floor, food covered with rigid shrouds of clear plastic. Soon, from outside, clank, drag, squeak of valve opening. Oh, yes, ah, yes, here are the men with the hoses to hose the place out. At which instant, with no warning, the arousing feather point of the sound shadow has touched you, enveloping you in sun silence for, oh, let us say, 2 hours, 36 minutes, 18 seconds to 2 hours, 36 minutes, 24 seconds, Central Wartime, unless the location is Dungannon, Virginia, Bristol, Tennessee, Asheville or Franklin, North Carolina, Apalachicola, Florida, or, conceivably, in Murdo Mackenzie, South Dakota, or Phillipsburg, Kansas, or Stockton, Plainville, or Ellis, Kansas. Yes, sounds like a roll of honor, don't it? Being read off someplace out on the prairie, foundry colors down the sky in long troughs, red and purple, darkening crowd of civilians erect and nearly touching as wheat stalks, and the one old man in black up at the microphone reading off the towns of the war dead, Dungannon, Bristol, Murdo Mackenzie, his white hair blown back by a sculpting thine alabaster city's wind into leonine wreathing, his stained, poured old face polished by wind, sandy with light, earnest outboard corners of his eyelids folding down as one by one, echoing out over the Anvil Prairie, the names of death towns unreal, and surely Bleicherode or Blissero will be spoken any minute now. Well, you're wrong, champ. These happen to be towns, all located on the borders of time zones, is all. Ha ha, caught you with your hand in your pants. Go on, show us all what you were doing, or leave the area. We don't need your kind around. There's nothing so loathsome as a sentimental surrealist. Now, the eastern towns we've listed are on eastern wartime. All the other towns along the interface are on central. The western towns just read off are on central, while the other towns along that interface are on mountain, which is all our sentimental surrealist leaving the area gets to hear. Just as well, he is more involved, or unhealthily obsessed, if you like, with the moment of sun silence inside the white tile greasy spoon. It seems like a place he has been, Kenosha, Wisconsin, already, though he can't remember in what connection. They called him the Kenosha Kid, though this may be apocryphal. By now, the only other room he can remember being in was a two-color room, nothing but the two exact colors for all the lamps, furniture, drapes, walls, ceiling, rug, radio, even book jackets in the shelves. Everything was either, one, deep, cheap perfume aquamarine, or two, creamy chocolate FBI shoe brown. That may have been in Kenosha, may not. If he tries, he will remember in a minute how he got to the white-tiled room half an hour before hose-out time. He is sitting with a coffee cup half full, heavy sugar and cream, crumbs of a pineapple Danish under the saucer where his fingers can't reach. Sooner or later, he'll have to move the saucer to get them. He's just holding off, but it isn't sooner and it isn't later, because the sound shadow comes down on him, settles around his table with the invisible long vortex surfaces that brought it here, swooping up away like whorls of an etheric Danish, audible only by virtue of accidental bits of sound debris that may happen to be caught in the eddying. Voices far away out at sea, our position is 27 degrees 26 minutes north, a woman crying in some high-pitched language, ocean waves and gale winds, a voice reciting in Japanese, Hi wa ri ni katazu, ri wa ho ni katazu, ho wa ken ni katazu, ken wa ten ni katazu, which is the slogan of a kamikaze unit, an Oka outfit. It means, Injustice cannot conquer principle. Principle cannot conquer law. Law cannot conquer power. Power cannot conquer heaven. He, ri, ho, ken, ten, go jap gibbering away on the long solar eddy and leave the Kenosha kid at the riveted pole where the roaring of the sun has stopped. He is hearing for the first time the mighty river of his blood, the Titan's drum of his heart. Come into the bulb shine and sit with him, with the stranger at the small public table. It's almost hosing out time. See if you can shadow, too. Even a partial eclipse is better than never finding out. Better than cringing the rest of your life under the great vacuum in the sky they have taught you, and a sun whose silence you never get to hear. What if there is no vacuum? Or if there is, what if they're using it on you? What if they find it convenient to preach an island of life surrounded by a void? Not just the earth and space, but your own individual life and time. What if it's in their interest to have you believing that? He won't bother us for a while, they tell each other. I just put him on the dark dream. They drink together, shoot very, very synthetic drugs into skin or blood, run incredible electronic waveforms into their skulls, directly into the brainstem, and backhand each other playfully with open-mouth laugh you know, don't you, is in those ageless eyes. They speak of taking so-and-so and putting him on the dream. They use the phrase for each other, too, in sterile tenderness when bad news is passed at the annual roasts, when the endless mind-gaming catches a colleague unprepared. Boy, did we put him on the dream. You know, don't you? Witty repartee. Ichizo comes out of the hut, sees Takeshi in a barrel under some palm leaves, taking a bath and singing doo-doo-doo-doo-doo, some Koto tune twanging through his nose. Ichizo screams, runs back inside, reemerging with a Japanese Hotchkiss machine gun, a Model 92, begins setting it up with a lot of jujitsu grunting and eye-popping. About the time he's got the ammo belt poised, ready to riddle Takeshi in the tub, Takeshi, wait a minute, what's all this? Ichizo, oh, it's you. I thought it was General MacArthur in his rowboat. Interesting weapon, the Hotchkiss. Comes in many nationalities, and manages to fit in ethnically wherever it goes. American Hotchkisses are the guns that raked through the unarmed Indians at Wounded Knee. On the lighter side, the racy 8mm French Hotchkiss, when fired, goes ho, 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 just as nasal and debonair as a movie star. As for our cousin John Bull, a lot of British Hotchkiss heavies were either resold privately after World War I or blowtorched. These melted machine guns will show up now and then in the strangest places. Pirate Prentice saw one in 1936 during his excursion with Scorpio Mossmoon at the Chelsea home of James Jello, that year's king of bohemian clowns. But a minor king from a branch prone to those loathsome inbred diseases, idiocy in the family, sexual peculiarities surfacing into public view at most inappropriate times, a bare penis dangling out of a dumpster one razor-clear and rain-washed morning in an industrial back street about to be swarmed up by a crowd of angry workers in button-top baggy caps carrying spanners 3 feet long, Kelly crowbars, lengths of chain. Here's bare-ass Crown Prince Porio with a giant halo of aluminum shaving curls on his head, his mouth made up with black grease, his soft buttocks squirming against the cold refuse, picking up steel splinters that sting deliciously, his eyes sultry and black as his lips. But, oh dear, what's this? Oh, how embarrassing. Here they come around the corner. He can smell the rabble from here, though they are not too sure about Porfirio. The march pauses in some confusion as these most inept revolutionaries fall to arguing whether the apparition is a diversionary nuisance planted here by the management or whether he's real decadent aristocracy to be held for real ransom, and if so, how much. While up on the rooftops, out from the brick and corrugated doorways begin to appear brown government troops manning British Hotchkisses, which were not melted down, but bought up by machine gun jobbers and sold to a number of minor governments around the world. It may have been in memory of Crown Prince Porfirio that day of massacre that James Jello kept a melted Hotchkiss in his rooms, or it may have been only another flight of grotesquerie. On dear James's part, you know, he's so unaware. heart to heart, man to man.
Son, been wondering about this, screwing in you kids are doing. This matter of the shooting electricity into head, ha-ha.
Waves, Pop. Not just raw electricity. That's for drips.
Yes, waves. Keying waves, right? Ha-ha. Tell me, son, what's it like? You know, I've been something of a doper all my life, and...
Oh, Pop, cripes, it isn't like dope at all.
Well, we got off on some pretty good vacations, we called them then. Some pretty weird areas they got us into, as a matter of fact.
But you always came back, didn't you?
What? I mean, it was always understood that this would still be here when you got back, just the same, exactly the same, right? Well, I guess that's why we called them vacations, son. 'Cause you always do come back to old reality land, don't you?
You always did.
This dangerous that stuff is. Suppose someday you just plug in and go away and never come back, eh?
Oh, don't I wish. What do you think every electro freak dreams about? You're such an old fuddy-duddy.
Hey, and who says it's a dream, huh?
But maybe it exists. Maybe there is a machine to take us away, take us completely, suck us out through the electrodes, out of the skull, and into the machine, and live there forever with all the other souls it's got stored there. It could decide who it would suck out and when.
Dope never gave you immortality. You had to come back every time into a dying hunk of smelly meat. But we can live forever in a clean, honest, purified electro world. Shit. That's what I get, having a dull Virgo for a son.
Some kind of Imipolex G. Imipolex G is the first plastic that is actually erectile. Under suitable stimuli, the chains grow cross-links, which stiffen the molecule and increase intermolecular attraction so that this peculiar polymer runs far outside the known phase diagrams, from limp, rubbery, amorphous to amazing, perfect tessellation, hardness, brilliant transparency, high resistance to temperature, weather, vacuum, shock of any kind, slowly gleaming in the void, silver and black, curve-warped reflections of stars flowing across down the full length of round and round in meridians exact as the meridians of acupuncture. What are the stars but points in the body of God where we insert the healing needles of our terror and longing? Shadows of the creature's bones and ducts, leaky, wounded, irradiated white, mingling in with its own. It is entangled with the bones and ducts, its own shape determined by how the erection of the plastic shall proceed. We're fast and we're slow. We're painful and we're slithery cool. Whether areas shall exchange characteristics of hardness and brilliance, whether some areas should be allowed to flow over the surface so that the passage will be a caress, we're to orchestrate sudden discontinuities, blows, wrenchings in among these more caressive moments. Evidently, the stimulus would have had to be electronic. Alternatives for signaling to the plastic surface were limited. A. A thin matrix of wires forming a rather close-set coordinate system over the imipolectic surface, whereby erectile and other commands could be sent to an area quite specific, say on the order of a half a square centimeter. B. A beam-scanning system, or several, analogous to the well-known video electron stream, modulated with grids and deflection plates located as needed on the surface, or even below the outer layer of Imipolex, down at the interface with what lies just beneath, with what has been inserted, or what has actually grown itself a skin of Imipolex G, depending which heresy you embrace. We need not dwell here on the primary problem, namely that everything below the plastic film does, after all, lie in the region of uncertainty, except to emphasize to beginning students who may be prone to schwärmerei that terms referring to the sub-inipolexity, such as core and center of internal energy, possess, outside the theoretical, no more reality than do terms such as supersonic region or center of gravity in other areas of science. C. Alternatively, the projection onto the surface of an electronic image analogous to a motion picture. This would require a minimum of 3 projectors and perhaps more. Exactly how many is shrouded in another order of uncertainty. The so-called Atyeyumbu indeterminacy relation. Probable functional derangement, gamma R, resulting from physical modification,
phi sub r, XYZ, is directly proportional to a higher power P of sub-imipolectic derangement gamma B, P being not necessarily an integer and determined empirically, in which subscript R is for rakete and B for blissero. Meantime, Chicherinya has found it necessary to abandon his smegma-gathering stakeout on the Argentine anarchists. The Heat, alias Nikolai Ripov, of the Commissariat for Intelligence Activities, is in town and closing in. The faithful Jabayev, in terror or disgust, has gone off across the cranberry bogs on a long wine binge with two local derelicts, and may never be back. Rumor says he is cutting a swath these days across the zone in a stolen American Special Services getup, posing as Frank Sinatra. Comes into town, finds a tavern, and starts crooning out on the sidewalk. Pretty soon there's a crowd, sub-deb cuties, each a $65 fine and worth every penny, dropping in epileptiform seizures into selfless heaps of cable stitching, rayon pleats and Christmas tree applique. It works. It's always good for free wine, an embarrassment of wine, rolling fooder and fass in a rumbling country procession through the sandy streets, wherever the drunkard's three find themselves. Never occurs to anybody to ask what Frank Sinatra is doing flanked by this pair of wasted rum-dums. Nobody doubts for a minute that it is Sinatra. Town hepcats usually take the other two for a comedy team. While nobles are crying in their knight's chains, the squires sing. The terrible politics of the Grail can never touch them. Song is the magic cape. Chicherinya understands that he is finally alone now. Whatever is to find him will find him alone. He feels obliged to be on the move, though there's no place for him to go. Now, too late, the memory of Wimpe, long ago I.G. Farben V-man, finds him, tags along for the run. Chicherinya was hoping he might find a dog. A dog would have been ideal, a perfect honesty to calibrate his own against day to day till the end. A dog would have been good to have along, but maybe the next best thing is an albatross with no curse attached, an amiable memory. Young Chicherinya was the one who brought up political narcotics, opiates of the people. Wimpe smiled back, an old, old smile to chill even a living fire in Earth's core. Marxist dialectics? That's not an opiate, eh? It's the antidote. No! It can go either way. The dope salesman may know everything that's ever going to happen to Chicherinya and decide it's no use, or, out of the moment's velleity, lay it right out for the young fool. The basic problem, he proposes, has always been getting other people to die for you. What's worth enough for a man to give up his life? That's where religion had the edge for centuries. Religion was always about death. It was used not as an opiate so much as a technique. It got people to die for one particular set of beliefs about death. Perverse, natürlich, but who are you to judge? It was a good pitch while it worked. But ever since it became impossible to die for death, we have had a secular version. Yours, die to help history grow to its predestined shape. Die knowing your act will bring a good end a bit closer. Revolutionary suicide, fine, but look, if history's changes are inevitable, why not die, Vaslav? If it's going to happen anyway, what does it matter? But you haven't ever had the choice to make, have you? If I ever did, you can be sure you don't know. Not till you're there, Wimpe. You can't say. That doesn't sound very dialectical. I don't know what it is. Then right up till the point of decision, Wimpe, curious but careful, a man could still be perfectly pure. He could be anything. I don't care. But he's only real at the point of decision. The time between doesn't matter. Real to a Marxist? No, real to himself. Wimpe looks doubtful. I've been there, you haven't. Shh. A syringe, a number 26 point. Blood's stifling in the Brownwood Hotel suite. To chase or worry this argument is to become word enemies, and neither man really wants to. Onarine theophosphate is one way around the problem. Chicherinya, you mean thiophosphate, don't you? Thinks, indicating the presence of sulfur. Wimpe, I mean theophosphate, Vaslav, indicating the presence of God. They shoot up. Wimpe eyeing the water tap nervously, recalling Tchaikovsky, Salmonella, a fast medley of whistleable tunes from the Pathétique. but Cicerone has eyes only for the point, its German precision, its fine steel grain. Soon he will come to know a circuit of aid stations and field hospitals, as good for post-war nostalgia as a circuit of peacetime spas. Army surgeons and dentists will bond and hammer patent steel for life into his suffering flesh and pick out what has entered it by violence with an electromagnetic device bought between the wars from Schumann of Düsseldorf, with a light bulb and adjustable reflector, 2-axis locking handles, and a complete set of weird-shaped polschuin, iron pieces to modify the shape of the magnetic field. But there in Russia, that night with Wimpe was his first taste, his initiation into the bodyhood of steel. No way to separate this from the theophosphate, to separate vessels of steel from the ungodly, insane rush. For 15 minutes, the two of them run screaming all over the suite, staggering around in circles, lined up with the room's diagonals. There is, in Laszlo Jamp's celebrated molecule, a particular twist, the so-called Perkler singularity, occurring in a certain crippled indole ring, which later Honorinists, academician, and working professional alike are generally agreed is responsible for the hallucinations which are unique to this drug. Not only audiovisual, they touch all senses equally, and they recur. Certain themes, mantic archetypes, as Jolly Fox of the Cambridge School has named them, will find certain individuals again and again with a consistency which has been well demonstrated in the laboratory. See Wobb and Wotan, Mantic Archetype Distribution Among Middle-Class University Students, J. Period, Onir. Period, Psi. Period, Farm. Period. Volume 23, pages 406 to 453. Because analogies with the ghost life exist, this recurrence phenomenon is known in the jargon as haunting. Whereas other sorts of hallucinations tend to flow by, related in deep ways that aren't accessible to the casual dope fiend, these onirine hauntings show a definite narrative continuity, as clearly as, say, the average Reader's Digest article. Often they are so ordinary, so conventional, Giac calls them the dullest hallucinations known to psychopharmacology, that they are only recognized as hauntings through some radical, though plausible, violation of possibility. The presence of the dead, journeys by the same route and means where one person will set out later but arrive earlier, a printed diagram which no amount of light will make readable, on recognizing that he is being haunted, the subject enters immediately into phase two, which, though varying in intensity from subject to subject, is always disagreeable. Often, sedation, 0.6 milligrams atropine subcutaneous, will be necessary even though onirine is classified as a CNS depressant. About the paranoia often noted under the drug, there is nothing remarkable. Like other sorts of paranoia, it is nothing less than the onset, the leading edge of the discovery that everything is connected, everything in the creation, a secondary illumination, not yet blindingly one, but at least connected, and perhaps a route in for those like Cicerone. Cicerone's haunting. As to whether the man is or isn't Nikolai Rypov, he does arrive the way Rypov is said to, heavy and inescapable. He wants to talk only to talk, but somehow, as they progress into the confusions of words, again and again he will trick Cicerone into uttering heresy, into damning himself. I'm here to help you see clearly. If you have doubts, we should air them, honestly, man to man, no reprisals. Hell, don't you think I've had doubts? Even Stalin's had them. We all have. It's all right, though. It isn't anything I can't handle. But you're not handling it, or they wouldn't have sent me out here. Don't you think they know when someone they care for is in trouble? Cicerone doesn't want to ask. He strains against it with the muscles of his heart cage. The pain of cardiac neurosis goes throbbing down his left arm. But he asks, feeling his breath shift a little, was I supposed to die? When, Václav? In the war. Oh, Václav, you wanted to hear what was troubling me. But don't you see how they'll take that? Come, bring it all the way out. We lost 20 million souls, Václav. It's not an accusation you can make lightly. They'd want documentation. Even your life might be in danger. I'm not accusing anyone. Please don't. I only want to know if I'm supposed to die for them. No one wants you to die. Soothing. Why do you think that? So it is coaxed out of him by the patient emissary, whining, desperate, too many words, paranoid suspicions, unappeasable fears, damning himself, growing the capsule around his person that will isolate him from the community forever.
Yet that's the very heart of history,
the gentle voice talking across twilight, neither man having risen to light a lamp. The inmost heart. How could everything you know, all you've seen and touched of it, be fed by a lie?
But life after death,
there is no life after death.
Chicherny means he's had to fight to believe in his mortality, as his body fought to accept its steel, fight down all his hopes, fight his way into the bitterest of freedoms. Not till recently did he come to look for comfort in the dialectical ballet of force, counterforce, collision, and new order.
Not till the war came and death appeared across the ring. Chicherny's first glimpse after the years of training, taller, more beautifully muscled, less waist motion than he'd ever expected, only in the ring, feeling the terrible cold each blow brought with it, only then did he turn to a theory of history, of all pathetic, cold comforts, to try and make sense of it.
The Americans say there are no atheists in foxholes. You were never of the faith, Vaslav. You had a deathbed conversion out of fear.
Is that why you want me dead now?
Not dead. You're not much use dead.
Two more olive-drab agents have come in and stand watching Chicherny. They have regular, unremarkable faces. This is, after all, an honorine haunting. Mellow, ordinary. The only tip-off to its unreality is the radical, though plausible, violation of reality. All three men are smiling at him now. There is no violation. It's a scream, but it comes out as a roar. He leaps at Ripoff, nearly nails him with his fist, too, but the others, with faster reflexes than he counted on, have come up either side to hold him. He can't believe their strength. Through the nerves of hip and ass, he feels his nagan being slid from its holster and feels his own cock sliding out of a German girl he can't remember now on the last sweet wine morning he saw her, in the last warm bed of the last morning departure.
You're a child, Vaslav, only making believe that you understand ideas which are really beyond you. We have to speak very simply for you.
In Central Asia, he was told of the functions of Muslim angels. One is to examine the recently dead. After the last mourner has gone, angels come to the grave and interrogate the dead one in his faith. There is another figure now at the edge of the room. She is Chicherny's age and in uniform. Her eyes don't want to say anything to Chicherny. She only watches. No music heard, no summer journey taken, no horse seen against the steppe in the last daylight. He doesn't recognize her. Not that it matters, not at this level of things, but it's Galina, come back to the cities, out of the silences after all, in again to the chain-link fields of the word, shining, running, secure, and always close enough, always tangible.
Why were you hunting your black brother?
Ripoff manages to make the question sound courteous.
Oh, nice of you to ask, Ripoff, why was I?
When it began, a long time ago at first, I thought I was being punished, passed over, I blamed him.
Now?
I don't know.
What made you think he was your target?
Who else's would he be?
Vaslav, will you never rise above? These are old barbarisms, bloodlines, personal revenge. You think this has all been arranged for you to ease your little stupid lusts?
All right, all right. Yes, probably, what of it?
He isn't your target. Others want him.
So you've been letting me...
So far, yes.
Chebaev could have told you. That sodden Asiatic is first and last an enlisted man. He knew officers. Fucking officer mentality. You do all the work, then they come in to wrap it up, to get the glory. You're taking it away from me.
You can go home.
Chicherny has been watching the other two. He sees now that they are in American uniform and probably haven't understood a word. He holds out his empty hands, his sunburned wrists, for a last application of steel. Ripoff, in the act of turning to leave, appears surprised.
Oh, no, no, you have 30 days survivor's leave. You have survived, Vaslav. You're to report to Tsagi when you get back to Moscow, that's all. There'll be another assignment. We'll be taking German rocket personnel out to the desert, to Central Asia. I imagine they'll need an old Central Asia hand out there.
Chichar understands that in his dialectic, his own life's unfolding, to return to Central Asia is, operationally, to die. They have gone.
The woman's iron face, at the very last, did not turn back. He's alone in a gutted room, with the plastic family toothbrushes still in their holders on the wall, melted, strung downward in tendrils of many colors, bristles pointing to every black plane and corner and soot-blinded window. The dearest nation of all is one that will survive no longer than you and I, a common movement at the mercy of death and time, the ad hoc adventure. Resolutions of the Gross Suckling Conference. North? What searcher has ever been directed north? What you're supposed to be looking for lies south, those dusky natives, right? For danger and enterprise, they send you west, for visions east. But what's north? The escape route of the Anubis, the Kyrgyz Light, the Herero Country of Death. Ensign Morituri, Carol Eventier, Thomas Gwenhidwe, and Roger Mexico are sitting at a table on the red brick terrace of Der Grob Seugling, an inn by the edge of a little blue Holstein lake. The sun makes the water sparkle. The housetops are red, the steeples are white. Everything is miniature, neat, gently pastoral, locked into the rise and fall of seasons. Contrasting wood X's on closed doors. The brink of autumn, a cow says moo. The milkmaid farts at the milk pail, which echoes with a very slight clang, and the geese honk or hiss. The four envoys drink watered Moselle and talk mandalas. The rocket was fired southward, westward, eastward, but not northward, not so far. Fired south at Antwerp, the bearing was about 173 degrees. East, during testing at Peenemünde, 072 degrees. Fired west at London, about 260 degrees. Working it out with the parallel rulers, the missing, or if you want, resultant bearing comes out to something like 354 degrees. This would be the firing implied by all the others, a ghost firing which, in the logic of mandalas, either has occurred most secretly or will occur. End of side 22. To continue, change side selector switch and turn the cassette over.